once more under the once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Man, he scared me. I thought you were going to drop down to a lower.
Yes.
Are you feeling your testosterone lately or something?
I have a stuffy nose. That's what I'm feeling.
A stuffy node?
I have a stuffy node.
Oh. I noticed Rush Limbaugh had one of those, too. Anyway, woo, that means you're like Rush Limbaugh.
Well, I'm now, also human.
Well, that's 2 points. So, I mean, you know, you're getting there very quickly.
So we have a lot in common.
He doesn't have a beard. He's not bald-headed.
He has a nose.
He has a nose.
He has two ears.
I have two ears. Right.
Yeah. So in some ways, I am like Rush Limbaugh.
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
Yes. And
as are you.
And we're all made in the image of God, so in some ways, we're all like God.
Which image, though?
I don't know. Now we can get into some very serious questions. You are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach. I didn't do a disclosure in the first hour, so I'm going to do one now. The Personal Wealth Coach is a registered is an investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, as well as a radio program that is registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. And I'm supposed to disclose that because there's obviously a conflict of interest of some kind there. I haven't figured out what it is yet, but I'm sure there's something going on there that relates to what we're doing here. I don't know what it is, but something.
Noses, maybe?
I don't know.
Maybe humanity?
Something like that. But that's an interesting subject by itself. Telephone numbers, if you'd like to call us, and this is where you are, March 29th, Saturday, March 29th, in 2014. That means this is live. If it's some other date, then you can call. But
We may be here to answer, but it won't be on
right.
the subject.
There'll be a time differential, and you might be on the moon. Or we might be on the moon, which is more likely. But if you'd like to call us,
we are loony.
And it is the 29th of March where you are, then 773-1400 is the number in East Bell County. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400 anywhere else within the sounds of our voices.
Whoa, I like that.
Yeah, I know. I realize that you like that.
It's very romantic. And
anytime I
radio.
Don't say it, you say it for me.
Right. Well, actually, what I say is anywhere else in the sound of your voice.
Right.
But you brought me into it. That's really cool. The market, it was an interesting week in the stock market.
Not much happened.
Well, actually,
the end result was the same as the beginning result.
Well, it was down about 1%.
It was down, and then it was back up, and now we're about flat.
Oh, okay.
For the week.
Oh.
Right?
I was thinking it was like down. No, it's down 0.5. Well, it all depends.
Which, the NASDAQ's down a little bit
for the
week.
The trader in Barron's said it was down 1%. So let's see. For the week, oh, boy. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 0.12%.
That's what I'm saying.
The S&P 500 was down 0.48%. The NASDAQ was down 2.83%. So what happened in the stock market this week? Stuff.
Which one?
This is the interesting thing to me. I said last hour, and I mean it, if there ever was a truth, there are two things that I know of that are almost perfectly counterintuitive for humans. No, there's actually more than
there's
two.
A lot of things that
but
are
there's,
counterintuitive.
There's two things that are almost perfectly counterintuitive. One of them is quantum mechanics, quantum physics, and the other one is investing. And this is something that in the over 30 years that I've been doing, this is Jeff, I've noticed whenever our clients, who are generally pretty even-tempered about the market, that we don't get a lot of panic calls.
They're pretty savvy.
And whenever we do get calls or comments from our clients, why am I invested in this? Or
fill in the blank.
Hadn't we better get out of that or something to that effect, where people have an intuition. In other words, they intuitively feel like that whatever they're invested in is something that they should be afraid of and they should get out of. That means it's about to rise. This is interesting. For the last year, and a little more, the market asset class that we refer to as diversified emerging markets has fallen. And it has not done well at all. While the last year, the domestic large cap, large capitalization companies that are traded in, that are based in the United States, did just exceptionally well. And so the patience of at least some of our clients has been worn a little thin, and so they're questioning, why are we invested in diversified emerging markets? Well, this week, with the S&P 500 down 0.5%, emerging markets was up 3%. And this is the pattern that we'll probably be seeing moving forward, right, by the way. And that is one of the most fascinating things. Whatever you intuitively want to get out of is by definition low, which is the time to buy.
Yeah.
And whatever you intuitively want to get more of because it's been going up historically is by definition high. And if you're going to get out of something, it would be that.
Right. And this is great because we talked a little bit about this last hour, but I'm going to apply it to emerging markets. We talked about beef prices at the store causing cattle to be worth more that aren't beef yet. Okay, so, I mean, it seems to us to be pretty common sense.
Well, it has transitioned from Anglo-Saxon to
French.
To French.
Yeah, so is it either cow or beef?
Boof.
It depends on which language you're speaking,
right,
and whether or not the creature in question is alive or dead.
Right.
So if you look at emerging markets in the same light as cow or beef, well, we're not going to eat them. Let's rephrase that. But the concept of what causes an emerging market to rise. They have been unemerged. They have been wherever they are emerging from for a long time. What is causing them to emerge? And what, you know, this whole concept of emerging is quite funny to begin with. What's causing them to emerge is low-cost labor for those of us that are already industrialized and have emerged into whatever it is that we emerged into, some kind of some great brilliance or something. I don't know. Nobody ever explains that part of it. But we are paying for them to make stuff for us.
Stuff. That's
stuff.
An economic term.
When we have a recession, they still have all these orders on hand, and they're making stuff, and they're going, all right, this is great. We're doing wonderful stuff. We're emerging here. Look at us. We're emerging very quickly. Look, I'm making a shoe. I'm emerging. Then we have a recession, and we stop ordering so much. And they're still working on the stuff we already ordered, and they're sending, and these companies over in the United States are saying, we're going to need more of this because they're spending a lot over here. And then we stop spending. And so the companies say, well, I'm not going to order as many. And so the emerging markets stop emerging so fast. They start going, whoa, I was building 3 shoes yesterday, and now I'm building 1 shoe. This causes emerging markets to go down, but it goes down after we do.
So that's the shoe theory of emerging
markets? Yes, shoe theory of emerging markets.
Well, it gets
This is the next thing. As our indicators go up, our consumer spending is going up, the demand for the products that we want to buy from emerging markets is going up. The orders have gone out, but it hasn't really gone into their system yet. They're beginning the process of doing this. I can look around at consumer sentiment in the United States, the amount of spending that we're doing now, and tell you without any doubt that the emerging markets are going to benefit from that.
I was going to give you credit because you have been forecasting a rise in emerging markets for some time now. We generally come a little early to the party.
Yeah, we probably a year and a half or 2 years early. We got out of natural resources a year and a half or so early. I mean, gold is part of that. We got out of real estate about a year and a half early. We got into real estate when nobody. This is the sort of thing that we're talking about.
This is something called what Jake was just talking about. Is something called, if you want to look it up or you go to the Oracle, and the Oracle will tell you all about it. Oracle at Google.
Yes.
Something called the corn hog cycle.
Yeah.
But it's become more complex. It isn't as simple as it used to be. The mere fact that we've injected beef into the corn hog cycle makes it far more complex.
I'm glad you caught that reference. It's just
What's that?
The beef into the corn hog cycle. Yes. I just had to throw that in. And I didn't think anybody was going to care, but I knew you would be
but
listening.
But you notice it's not the corn pork cycle. Now, I think this is interesting because hog, by the way, I'm going to geek out here for just a moment.
Let's geek out and explain what it is we're talking about instead of thinking of a hog being rolled around with some corn.
Well, let's back up a step even before that. This is Jeff again. I have my bachelor's degree is in cultural anthropology, and I have studied etymology for a long time, which has nothing to do with insects, has to do with the study of words as sort of an archaeological study of where our culture came from. You can tell, or a person, if I were to say it, one can tell that what animals were domesticated in England at the time of the Norman conquest. And you can tell that because there are two words for those animals.
Yeah.
When it's in the field,
it's a pig.
It's a pig or a hog. When it is on the table, it becomes pork. When it's in the field, it is cow. When it comes to your table, it's boeuf, which is French. All these are French words.
Right.
By the way, at that point in time, deer were
venison.
They were domesticated. They belonged to the lords who owned the land, and so we have deer in the field and venison on the table. By the way, that means they didn't have chickens. You can tell because it's chicken in the yard.
It's chicken on the table.
But
chickens were kind of annoying little creatures at the time.
The corn hog cycle is about the fact that that's the longest studied economic cycle in since we've been studying economic cycles, and which has been a long time. And that is that somebody in the Renaissance period, nobody knows who did this originally because there's a lot of discussion about it, noticed that there was a cyclical rise and fall in when we say corn, that's a generic term, by the way.
Corn just means a type of grain.
Yeah, it was barley corn because the corn that we call corn is actually maize and it gets kind of complicated.
Well, corn just means a grain. If you think of a peppercorn, that's corn.
So the rise and fall of actually barley, was out of sync with, but in the same frequency and length as the rise and fall in hog prices. But they lagged each other, and there's a whole study that goes into the fact that when people are buying hogs, they wind up buying a lot of corn. And then they sell off the hogs, but the corn farmers continue to farm more corn, and then the hog buyers have sold off all their hogs. And I mean, this is the point. It gets more
moving
complicated
back and
here.
Forth.
This is just a two-part cycle. If you want something really exciting, well, by our definition.
Everybody else is going to sleep, and we're going, oh, this is so exciting.
The emerging markets no longer just sell to people like us.
They sell to each other and themselves.
Yeah. The biggest purchaser of that economic term again, stuff, from emerging markets over the last decade or so has been China.
Yeah. If you think the biggest purchaser of Chinese goods, amazingly, is China.
Wow. No.
Yeah, seriously.
Well, that may be, but what I'm saying is, for instance, something that's made in, I don't know.
Thailand
is more likely to be sold to China than it is to the United States at this point. And here's the interesting thing. The people in China, the economy in China is largely based on exports. They are selling things to the United States. They receive money from the United States for selling things to us.
And they buy stuff from Thailand.
They turn around and buy things from Thailand.
Or Vietnam.
Vietnam or something. And the reason they do this is because the labor is cheaper in there than it is where they are. And the same thing, by the way, is happening in India. India is...
Prices are going up.
As their middle class rises... They are buying things from lower wage countries. By the way, the Indians and the Chinese are still selling things to us, including their time, call centers and things like that. So it becomes a lot more complicated. But by the time you get past the big emerging market countries like India and Russia and China and Brazil – and you get to the third tier down there of emerging market countries, which is sometimes now called developing markets.
They're developing into emerging.
Right. They're developing to become emergent, to become emergent.
So they're pre-developed, unemerged.
Yes.
Right.
Weird. The point is that the lag in this system has become longer and longer and more complex, so that we have been in the United States in a recovery since late 2009.
Uh-huh.
Healthy recovery here in the United States for 5 years. The lag effect entering into the economic recovery is just now hitting the emerging markets.
And if you think about the rest of the world, for instance, Southern Europe, they're
headed the other direction.
They're headed the other direction, and that has an impact on emerging markets as well, because they were buying stuff from them before and not so much anymore.
Well, actually, there ought to be a new name for someplace like Spain.
Undeveloping market.
Diverging market.
Right.
I think it'd be diverging. I've been trying to come up with a term for it. I'd like to invest in the diverging markets that are going downhill. No.
The Spanish are saying, well, yes, we have emerged, but we are going back. We would rather go back than go forward because this whole emerging thing is it's so exciting. Look, we can do it again.
But it is it's the root word of emergency, so obviously there's something wrong.
Right. Something new and exciting.
Which brings us to another subject. By the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number's in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
There was some disturbing news this week.
Oh, dear. Should I get some tissue?
You might. Yeah. It's pretty serious. And I'm not kidding about this. We've been talking about it a long time. Inflation is down.
I should get some tissue.
The Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, which I'm sure it's actually called the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index.
It's exciting reading.
PCEPI. Boy, you have to be a geek even to know this thing exists. This leaves housing out. This is basically the index of what people buy on a regular basis and then consume. It leaves out the major long-term theoretical issues like what is the potential rent value of your house? By the way, that is a big component in the consumer price index.
Yeah.
As if you're consuming your house every month, which
that's some people do.
I don't think people do that very often.
But some people get really hungry and
I guess they could consume their house. It's the theoretical rental value of your house, which
weird. I like theoretical rent. It pays all my theoretical bills.
Right. Doesn't work real well. The point is that the Federal Reserve, when they are attempting to hold prices at a reasonable level to keep inflation from happening and deflation from happening, do not pay a lot of attention to the Consumer Price Index. What they pay a lot of attention to is the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index. And that's why they have really long meetings, because in order to say the names of these things.
Yeah, in order to say the names of the things, the meetings get longer. Every time you mention the thing, we need a four-hour radio program if we talk about it for very long.
Right. Instead of the CPI, it'd be the
PCEPPI. PCEPPI. There it is, yeah.
Anyway.
Pikepi.
Whatever it is. The point is that the thing is now down below, on an annualized basis, is now below 1%. And the Federal Reserve chair and their minutes, you think of something that takes 2 days would have more than minutes. But
there's a lot of minutes in 2 days.
Yeah, but their minutes aren't all that long. So they have short minutes, which means it must be a really exciting meeting. Anyway, what they've said over and over again is they have a target of 2% inflation. And you say, I don't want 2% inflation. Well, the fact is they found out that a lot of studies have come to the conclusion that economies function a lot better.
With
2% inflation. You expect prices to go up. You'll buy something sooner rather than later.
Right.
Our inflation in the United States in 2009-10 timeframe actually dropped down. Officially, the Consumer Expenditure Price Index dropped to 1.5% on an annualized basis. It's below 1% now. And that is not a good thing. In other words, if you listen to Glenn Beck or any of the people who said we're going to have runaway inflation and you should buy gold or whatever, folks, the opposite has happened, which tells you how much you should actually listen to anybody who says you should do things like that.
Right, and how much you should even listen to us, for that matter.
But this is, and we've been worried about deflation for several years, and it's coming. The price index in Southern Europe, specifically in Spain, is negative right now. The prices on the things that people buy from month to month in Spain is falling.
And people go, well, why is that bad? You can buy a lot more stuff. Well, your wages fall faster than the prices at the store, and that's part of the problem. And that means that the prices at the store have to fall, which means that the people that are at the store that are getting paid based on the prices at the store have their wages fall and so on. It's not a good cycle. It's really bad if you have a mortgage because you have a 30-year mortgage with a payment going out, and it's the same payment over that 30-year period. And if your wages fall, it's not a good thing.
Particularly if the local taxing district is raising your taxes because they have less money coming in because of deflation.
Right. Inflation tends to be more detrimental to very wealthy people. But they can afford it a little bit better. Deflation.
A little bit.
Yeah. Deflation tends to be very, very good for very wealthy people and really bad for less wealthy people. For the majority of Americans, it is very, very bad.
And this is something, very frankly, if you're going to worry about some things, people really need something to worry about.
Oh, yes.
Then the thing.
Besides lightning, tornadoes.
Hailstorms.
Yeah. Deflation.
If you wanted to worry about something, it would be deflation. Because in a deflationary environment, for example, your house will be worth less in the future than it is today. In a deflationary environment, virtually everything you own will become worth less with each passing year. And there's a real good reason that we have a negative connotation of the term worthless. Because it's bad. It's really hard. There'll be rising unemployment because as prices fall, the people who own businesses can't afford to have as many people there. Europe, for the first time, the European Union is going to actually vote, and they probably will come out in favor of starting, we're ending it, starting quantitative easing, meaning that they're going to go out and start buying bonds. The European Central Bank will be authorized to go out and buy bonds.
They should have done this years ago. They should have done this in 2008.
The Spanish, who have been really, really good. By the way, if you ever want to take a serious look at what, if you're a Tea Party conservative and you want to see exactly what an experiment going on following exactly the doctrine of Tea Party conservatism, go to Spain. Spain has pulled the fiscal reins in tightly. They have been very compliant with the European Central Bank and the Germans' demand that they stop spending so much money at the governmental level and get their debts down and get rid of their deficit and lower their governmental expenditures and not raise taxes. And they did all of that stuff, and their economy has gone back into recession.
Austerity doesn't work in recessions.
It puts you back
in recession.
And they
austerity works really well when you're in a booming economy. Mm-hmm.
They have effectively what we would call a depression. They now have 30% unemployment, which constitutes, in our terms, that's our unemployment rate that we had in the United States in the 1930s.
Yeah, if you look at their unemployment rate in the people age 16 to 30, you're talking about almost 50%.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about half of the people in that age group are without work.
And there's another fascinating thing that came in at the same time. And the fact that it happened in one state does not prove any particular point, but it is what's called a confirmation, a little confirmation point. The most conservative state in the United States, electorally, and a whole lot of other ways, is North Carolina. It is where the Civil War started. It is, they kind of lead the conservative pack as they move forward. they had the highest, they had a far worse recession than did the rest of the country. And as they have led the way in getting deficit cutting. For example, not only did they reject the money from the federal government for Obamacare, they stopped unemployment insurance, the extended unemployment insurance before the federal government did. If you go look at the employment statistics, they are losing jobs in North Carolina faster than any other state in the United States. Now, is their unemployment rate necessarily very high? No.
Because people are leaving.
They're leaving North Carolina and going someplace else to find a job, which is something you can do in the United States. But they actually are far worse than the more northern states where Michigan, you would think, okay, there's where the big job loss is going to occur. No, the biggest job loss percentage-wise in the United States has been, oddly, in North Carolina. And this is just this is one of the things that I love about the United States of America.
We can experiment.
Right. We have these 50 experiments going at the same time, trying to do things differently. The only thing that puzzles me is when people see somebody else do something that really damages their economy.
And we do it again.
And
we
then
do
we
it
do
too.
It too, you know?
Well, this is an example of why Texas is doing so well. As Texas followed both sides of the economic world that are usually developed and separated out and said this is one political spectrum and that's the other and they should argue with each other. They don't really argue with each other economically, which is don't run a deficit every year. Get a surplus. Get that surplus. We call it a rainy day fund. When we have a rainy day, spend the rainy day fund.
We had one yesterday.
Yes, I recognize. We had a Haley day and rainy day yesterday. When Texas has this big surplus, and they do, they stick that money in the rainy day fund. When we were in the middle of the recession, they spent money from the rainy day fund. We would call that stimulus. So they were spending during the recession more money than they were taking in from
tax
revenue.
Deficit spending.
Deficit spending, except we had money to do it with. This is a very effective, and you look at what Texas did during the recession as far as the recovery and everything else, that's the way we should be doing it across the board. Every state should be doing that. But if they did, then Texas wouldn't stand out so well. So, hey, I don't want to wish bad things on them, but it's really nice to point at Texas and say, we're here, this is a great state, and those other places aren't doing so well, so here we are.
Yeah, okay. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, by the way. Telephone numbers to call in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. We have to talk about pensions later this hour.
We have to do some commercials, too.
Yes, so let's do that.
Do you want to do the commercials or the pensions?
Let's do both, but not at the same time.
Okay. Well, we'll do the commercials, and then we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Internet. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
Only have about 20 minutes left this episode.
This is an episodic event?
It is.
Excuse me, sir, you have an episodic event.
Yeah.
How long have you had these episodes?
Since 1998.
And when did you first start hating your father?
We said we were going to talk about pensions a little bit.
Pension.
Yes. And
which has a completely different meaning in Europe than it does here.
Right. Pension in Europe is something.
A small hotel.
Yes.
Pension.
All right. So, well, that's really the English started using the money to that they would pay to family members and wards and such to pay for their housing. The hotel stay was a pension. Mm-hmm. That's where that comes from. Anyway, the whole concept of what we do today, whether you have a 401k or a fixed benefit pension plan, there is something interesting that you should know.
Really?
Well, there's a lot of things you should know, but specific to this, when you begin those plans, they're generally voluntary. You reduce your income by the amount of money that goes into the plan, whether it's a 401k or a pension. Some form of money is taken from you in this process. And when the lawyers are talking about it, when the company is talking about it, they refer to that money as their own, because you reduced your income to put money in a 401k, or you reduced your income to put money in the pension. The company puts money in those places as well. They own that money.
And effectively, they owe you a debt.
They owe a debt. That is correct.
So it's very similar to purchasing a bond or something from the company.
Right. And you don't get to manage that money any more than they allow you to. So in a fixed pension plan, you don't really get to say anything about where the money is in there. You just get a statement every once in a while that says this may be coming to you at some point in the future. And if you're lucky, they say this is the total value that may belong to you at some point in the future if you decide not to take an income from it. In a 401k, they say, sure, you can manage this however you like, as long as you do it the way we want you to.
Well, there are rare exceptions where they have self-directed 401k.
Right, and in those cases, they've said, we're allowing you to do that. Mm-hmm. They can turn that off at any point.
Right.
It's up to them. They can say, we don't want you to have money invested in the overall stock market. We want you to choose between these three investments, or this one investment, for that matter. They get to say that because it's their money. They own your pension. And in the cases of something called ERISA retirement plans. ERISA is an act that was passed in 1974 that basically says the Labor Department's going to be very upset with the employer if they don't treat that money in your best interest.
Maybe. But actually, they aren't very upset because they don't have a police force.
Right. Anyway, basically what it's saying is they've got to treat it like it's yours even though it's theirs. When we're talking about a 457 plan, things change. And I want to make this very clear. There's a lot of people out there in the Scott and White area and in other areas that have 457 plans. And I'm specifically talking about non-governmental 457s. In the world of the ERISA plans, where you have a 401k or a pension, if the company you're working for gets sued, the creditors can't touch those assets. Your pension is free from the lawsuit. They're not allowed to touch it.
And that's called an ERISA qualified plan. Or
right.
We refer to them as a qualified plan.
Correct. A 457 is a deferral plan where you're taking money that you would receive today and you say, I'm going to take that money instead of receiving it today. I'm going to put it in this account. And then later on down the road, I'll be able to take that as income. And you have generally the same investment options mm-hmm. in the 457 as you would in the 401k or 403b or whatever. Here's the difference. That money still belongs to the company, just like the other one. However, that money is subject to the creditors in lawsuits, as if this is a non-governmental plan, that's subject to the creditors of the company. So be aware of that. And in retirement, we generally recommend taking from the 457 first, because you can't roll that over into an IRA. You can't do a lot of the other things that you can do with ERISA plans. With a 457, you have to spend that money to deplete it. We recommend depleting it first, and then we go on to the other things.
And just to give you a little, an interesting little oddity of tax law, the reason, well, the 457 plan is actually deferred compensation.
Right. And 401ks right. And pension plans, they're right. called deferral plans as well.
But they're very different.
Right.
Because they're covered under ERISA, and they're protected from the creditors of your parent company. However, by definition, a salary deferral program, which is the 457 plan, must be, I love the language in the tax law here, it's actually in the code, must be subject to a substantial risk of loss.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it. It says in there that that retirement program, in order to not be included in your paycheck, must be subject to a substantial risk of loss. Now, you got to think about that for a little bit to see the humor in it.
Yeah.
The government will give you a tax break, particularly if you're working for a nonprofit organization. So they, you know, it's they don't have a profit anyway. If they put your money someplace where there's a substantial risk of loss, they'll allow you to not pay taxes on it. Yeah, I love that thought process.
Now, before you panic, most 457s are run very well. And I don't know of any instances where there's a lot of liability expected to hit there. But it is a risk that needs to be, you need to be aware of this risk. It is, just like any other risk, something that if you don't know about, you can't plan for.
There is, let me say that there is a risk. If you were working, for example, for King's, well, I don't know if it happened at King's Daughters, but if you were working for a hospital that went out of business, that had to declare bankruptcy, and there have been a lot of those, or yeah. Let's put it like this, Enron had a 457 plan.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody...
They had a deferred compensation plan.
They had a deferred compensation plan. It was under a different number.
Yeah,
but
it's a
still,
different number.
But the bottom line to it is they had the equivalent of a 457 plan, and their upper-income employees saw that as basically the same thing as their 401k. Well, the interesting thing, if they didn't involve... Unless they, of course, put all their money in Enron stock, which wasn't really brilliant... If they had a 401k with no money in Enron stock in it, Enron went bankrupt. They were undamaged. If they had a salary deferral plan at Enron, the equivalent of a 457 plan, they simply lost the money.
And they're called a non-qualified deferred compensation plan or NQDC.
But there's actually a number that's sometimes associated with it. I don't remember what it is. But the point is that it's an important thing to be aware of. The other thing, of course, is a 457 cannot be rolled over into an IRA because
correct.
It's not an ERISA-qualified plan. If you take the money out of it, if you roll it out...
You got to pay taxes on it.
And it's a really peculiar situation because you have to leave it with a company...
That you're no longer with.
With that company recognizing that if something happens and that company goes broke, and people say, well, I'm sure this company won't go broke. That's the kiss of death because this one of the things in retirement that is so critical, we've looked at a lot of history, and that's the reason we don't advocate using one of the principal reasons other than the fact that they're a nightmare from four different directions. We do not recommend indexed annuities, and the reason is really quite simple. If you're looking at 30 years, which is, I think, a reasonable time horizon for most people who purchase an indexed annuity, and typically a 15-year major surrender charge, so you're going to lose money for the first 15 years, what you're saying is, I am betting all of this money on that insurance company still being in business and able to pay all of its debts, including me, for 30 years into the future. And yes, failures of insurance companies are reasonably rare. However, over a 30-year period, if you were to do some research and figure out how many insurance companies have failed over the last 30 years,
that's a lot.
You would be surprised. And this is something that's very, very important to recognize about this point in history. We are in a period of rapid technological change and collapsing information costs. Much higher economic variability or volatility, if you want to put it that way, will occur, which means companies that were stable, healthy, wonderful companies a few years ago don't exist today. Sears used to be the bedrock of retail, and it's struggled through bankruptcy and is probably headed back to bankruptcy again. Montgomery Ward went completely out of business. You go down the list of stable companies. Who would have ever thought that General Motors, those of you who are older, like me, probably...
Older than what? That's
remember the saying from the chairman of General Motors, what's good for General Motors is good for America. What's good for America is good for General Motors. General Motors effectively became part was the cornerstone of the United States of America economically. And General Motors went through bankruptcy. If you had a deferred compensation plan, non-qualified deferred compensation plan at General Motors, and many of its executives did. A lot of times, by the way, these deferred compensation plans are in the stock of the company. And when a company goes bankrupt, the stock isn't worth a lot. But it's just one of those things, like Jake said, that's really crucial to be aware of. And if you have enough money, if you have a high enough income, that it makes sense for you to be in a 457 plan or a deferred compensation plan, very frankly, you need to have an independent registered investment advisor advising you. If you don't, you're probably dealing with somebody who's not qualified to advise you on that stuff.
Right. Anyway. So basically, what we're saying about 457s or any other deferred compensation that's not considered a qualified plan, check and see what the insurance is that's being held on the assets of the, and in a lot of cases, they don't have it.
They so can't actually
check on that. Actually, well, there's some non-qualified plans can have insurance written on it, but it's...
But they actually, that's what, well, this is a point.
You have to have substantial risk of loss.
I just went through that. If they write insurance so that you effectively eliminate the
then
risk of loss in the case of the failure of the company or the company gets sued or something, then it's no longer, they have to tax, instantly they become taxable to the people who receive them.
Right. And there's one other aspect that I wanted to hit here, and this is one that I see so often, and it shocks me every time, because the people that do this generally are very well educated, intelligent, brilliant people, and they do this. If you need to take a loan and you've got a large 401k or 403b and you need to take a loan because you're out of cash for something, you've got to pay for college or you want to buy a car or you want to buy a house, if you have any other options besides taking it from your retirement plan, please do it. Don't take it from your retirement plan. And I have to explain this to people, very intelligent people. Your retirement plans, your 403b or your 401k, whatever the plan may be, you haven't paid taxes on that stuff yet. If you take a loan from that plan, everything's great. You're not going to pay a high interest rate, though sometimes you do. Sometimes the interest rate on the loan is like 8%, which is more than you would probably get charged at a bank. You get, say, $30,000 from your retirement plan. You pay for your kids' first year of college, and you start paying back the loan to the plan. So you've got whatever interest rate the plan is charging. Now you're paying back that money with money you've already paid taxes on. So whatever tax bracket you're in, just call it 30%. The money that's going back into that plan, you've already paid $9,000 of taxes on if you're in the 30% area. You took $30,000 and you're paying it back. So $9,000 of that is extra. It's more than what you took out. It's $9,000 more than what you took out. So you paid a 30% penalty for putting it back in. And when you retire, you're going to have to pay it again. You're going to have to pay taxes on the money you already paid taxes on because you paid it back with loan money that you took from.
And there's another aspect to this. If you get a job offer, you owe $30,000 to your retirement plan, and you get a job offer somewhere else and you decide to switch from one company to the other,
you've got to pay that tax and penalty right now if you leave employment.
You'll owe the taxes on the $30,000.
What's more, if you
plus
get
a
fired,
10% penalty if you get fired.
If you get laid off or fired, you owe that right away, or you owe taxes and a 10% penalty to the IRS, and they're not really friendly about that.
And it is, you either have to pay the $30,000 back out of pocket immediately. And believe me, if you've just lost your job, banks have this tendency not to want to loan you $30,000.
Right, plus 10% and taxes. But
that's not the big one. We're almost out of time here. But I want to tell you what the big one is. If, let's just say for the sake of argument, that you got the same return, gross return, that the stock market has gotten roughly since the beginning of the 20th century, which is about 10% a year. That means that the value of that money you took out doubles every 7 years. So let's just say 28 years from now in your retirement, how much would that $30,000 have been worth? It would be
a lot.
It would go to 60, then to 120. You basically are taking $240,000 out of your plan and you're paying a $30,000 bill with it, and then you're going to pay it back with 30% interest.
Yeah.
And that is...
It's almost, plus whatever interest the plan was charging for the loan. So yeah. Just be aware, if you can get... I know a lot of people, they just don't want to go to a bank and get a loan. They don't want to get a credit card out and pay for it. They look at it and they say, oh, but this charges 12% interest. You're going to pay more than that even if you pay it back tomorrow. If you pay it back tomorrow, you've already paid more interest by triple than what you would if you took it on a 12% credit card.
And it is...
We're not recommending going out and getting lots of credit card debt. Don't get us wrong. But if you have any other options besides taking a loan from your retirement account, we recommend those first.
Well, and the reason... that some of the people I've talked to have taken these loans is because they see it as a withdrawal.
Right.
Which, it's deadly.
Yeah, they say, it's a loan for myself. No, it isn't. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, we're about out of time.
Yes.
If you would like to contact us for, if you really disliked something that we said, or you really liked something that we said.
Or you just want to talk to us.
Yeah, or you just want to leave a long voicemail for no apparent reason, because we've done a long radio cast for no apparent reason.
Right.
You may contact us off the air through voicemail at
locally 947-1111.
Or you can reach us toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You may email us individually at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, tpwc.com or thepersonalwealthcoach.com. You can send us messages through there. You can also listen to our podcast. So if you really do like listening to us ramble on about all kinds of silliness, then there's lots and lots of us doing that on our webpage.
And just as a passing, Barron's cover article is Here Comes $75 Oil. The price of oil and the price of fuel will fall. The price of gold will fall. And a lot of people will be shocked, but an awful lot of people will not remember why they bought the stuff to begin with.
Right. And there's lots
that's
of other stuff to talk about there.
That's a forecast, folks. You can write it down. You know,
we could have spent the whole program talking about just that. So we'll leave the last 20 seconds of us talking about something like that just to
I'll
get
just,
you.
One other thing I want to throw in there. The price of oil will devastate, the falling price of oil will devastate Russia's economy, and they're going to get desperate. So hang on to your hats, folks. And this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Fair, balanced. Your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.